Welcome back to the Interlude Podcast. You are listening to episode 162, A Conversation with Jen Delvaux. Jen is the host of the podcast show, Not Today Cancer, and the author of Not Today Cancer, A Non-Typical Guide for the Girl Who Wants to Thrive, Not Just Survive. Jen herself is an integrative health practitioner. She's a proud mother of two. She's a caregiver to her husband who has completed treatment for brain cancer. And several years after he completed treatment, Jen herself was diagnosed with breast cancer. On today's episode, Jen shares her story, both as a caregiver and then as a patient, the changes that she's made in her life, how all of these experiences have impacted her marriage. She talks about her relationship, the importance of communication, and she talks a little bit about her goal, which is to empower women to take charge of their diagnosis and to thrive during and after treatment. She's the founder of the Reset and Rise community for women who have been affected by cancer, which aims to offer support, tools, resources to regain control over one's personal well-being, to feel heard, held, and good again. I love her mission. I love what she does. And it was truly an honor to get to speak with her today about her experiences, the personal changes she's made in her life, and how she's showing up for others to help them do the same. And so let's get right into it. It is truly an honor to welcome Jen Delvaux to the Interlude Podcast.
I'm your host, Dr. Eleanor Toplinski, and I am a board-certified medical oncologist specializing in the treatment of breast and gynecologic cancers. I started the Interlude Podcast as a way to share the journeys and experiences of women who are going through cancer. On this podcast, we talk about anything and everything related to the cancer journey, the treatment, and life after cancer. As a reminder, the information discussed on this podcast is not meant to serve as medical advice. Any specific medical questions should be directed to your healthcare team.
Jen, I'm so excited to have you here today. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I love sharing my story.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your story, who you are, what you do, all of that?
Yes. So my name is Jen Delvaux, and I was actually, cancer has been part of my life for many years. My husband was diagnosed with brain cancer back in 2009. We were like in our mid-30s, and it just kind of like rocked our worlds, had no idea what we were doing. And he's had like three brain surgeries, chemo, radiation. But after that first one, we just literally had no idea what we were doing. We were like just jumped into it. And then it came back shortly after, like about 18 months later. And so by that time, I had done a lot of research. So my cancer journey actually began with him having cancer. And I was in the fitness world, you know, like helping people get healthy and fit. And then I was diagnosed in 2021. So he was his last third brain surgery was in 2019. So do you mean to go into my diagnosis, the story of it?
So before you do, yeah. Finishes in 2019, right? You guys are starting to rebuild and figure that out. And walk me through kind of the emotions that happened when you were diagnosed. And I mean, that must have been so challenging on many
levels. Okay. So challenging because I am. So after his second brain surgery in 2011, he couldn't go back to work. So I just kind of took things over. I run the household. You wouldn't know it if you saw him, but he has short-term memory issues. He has some confusion. He was a pharmacist at the time, and you definitely wouldn't want him counting your drugs because he could no longer count like the simple things he couldn't do. So I kind of took care of everything, the house, the finances, just everything. And so it was 2021, and I want to say it was about 3 or 4 months prior to my diagnosis, I kept seeing this number 1111 daily, constantly. I was like, what does this mean? What? I'm so confused by this. And I one day like looked it up and it said like, pay attention. And I was like, okay. And I just thought, what is going on? And I'm like, am I due for my mammogram? And it was right after COVID and I was a little late for my mammogram, not a lot. So I called them. I'm like, is my mammogram due? They're like, yep, you're just past due by a little bit. So I scheduled that and went and had that mammogram. No big deal. I got a call back just a few days later. And she said, hey, we need you to come back. We're seeing something. And I was like, okay. Okay. And she said, do you want to know which breast? And I was like, sure. And in my head, I kept saying, it's my left. She's going to say it's your left. She's going to say it's your left, not knowing anything. And she said, it's your left. And I was like, okay, that freaked me out just a little bit, but I had never felt anything. Yeah. It wasn't like, this was just a routine mammogram. I didn't feel anything. So I go to this repeat mammogram and ultrasound, and the way it's set up in my place, and this is probably most places, but you go in for that mammogram. If they still see it, you go back for the ultrasound. And then if they're still seeing it and they're concerned, then you see the doctor. So your hope is not to ever reach that yeah. doctor, mm-hmm. right? Okay.
Yep.
So I go in for that the mammogram, and she's like, yep, we're still seeing it. So she sends me back into the waiting room. And so I even put on my Instagram stories. I'm like, how many of you get called back for a repeat mammogram? And it was, the percentage was like so high, like 90%. And it turns out to be nothing. So I wasn't worried, and then go back for this ultrasound. And that was when I kind of started freaking out, because she was staying in one spot for a really long time. And I was like panicking. And then she said, I'm going to go get the doctor. And I was like, oh, I'm in trouble. Like, this can't be good. And I remember I was texting my sister, and she's like, you're fine. You're fine. Everything is going to be fine. Like, I went through this. I'm like, okay. She literally had just gone through a biopsy the month prior, and it ended up being fine. So she comes in, or the doctor comes in, like with the saddest face. And he's like, we are suspecting this is cancer. And I was like, really? And I still didn't believe it. I still didn't believe it. I was like, there's no way. There is no way husband and wife can both have cancer. There's no way. He was like, do you have questions? I'm like, nope. I just wanted to get out of there. I didn't want to ask anything. I didn't want to know anything. I called another friend who had recently been through a cancer diagnosis herself. And she was like, well, the good news is they didn't call you back for a biopsy right away. I'm like, you're right. I'm good. This is going to be nothing. I wasn't like that freaked out yet. I get home. Literally 5 minutes after being in the door, I get a phone call, and it's the nurse. And she's like, the doctor looked over everything again, and he is really suspecting this is cancer. We need you back ASAP first thing in the morning. I was like, and then my world just shut down. Yeah. Literally, I don't think I've cried so much in my life. I was so petrified.
And what happened after that? How did you... you know, how do you make those next steps, right? In that fear, yeah. you still have yeah. to put one foot in front of the other, and you still mm-hmm. have to show up to that biopsy.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. So that night I cried a lot, and I let it all out. I was just like, all this fear, and that's not typically me. Like, I'm the strong one. I'm the one that cares for the family. And in my head the whole time I was thinking, like, who's going to help everybody if I'm not here? You know, I think when you hear the words, because I had already at this point, I kind of knew that now I was going to get a cancer diagnosis because of what she said. So when you hear those words, you immediately think your life is over. You think, like, this is it. Like, you know, you think it's probably everywhere, and it's, you know, and I finally got to sleep that night at some point. And I woke up the next morning, and I'm like a big morning person. Like, I love morning routine. And I got up and I'm like, I can do this. I got this. And I started like writing down my affirmations and just listening to some personal development, like getting my day straight. And then I looked at my email and I looked at my chart, and I saw, that was after the fact. I think I saw BI-RADS 5. That would be after the...
That would be at the time of the mammogram.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I did see BI-RADS 5 that time. And I was like, I thought that was like the worst. This is why I always say, don't look at your my chart until you're sitting with the doctor, because Google is not your friend. When you're Googling that sort of stuff, you need to be with the doctor, because our minds can go to the craziest mm-hmm. places.
Yeah.
But what I did that morning, so I was in panic, like straight panic. I was like, how am I going to drive myself to this biopsy appointment, because I was just out of control fear. And I grabbed my phone and I searched like on my apps, like some sort of meditation. And I found an app, Unplug, I mean, there's a million other ones out there. There's free ones on YouTube, but for some reason, this app is what I first saw. And I found one that was called Your Superpower Calm. And it was the first moment I felt calm. And it was the first moment that I was like, okay, I can do this. Was listening to that 1 10-minute meditation.
And, you know, and I would say that meditation, I think people kind of brush it off like as like, oh, it's not going to help me. But I can't tell you how many people it grounds you in that moment, you know?
And I don't know where I'd be without it. And I was the type of person prior to my diagnosis, I'm type A, go, 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 always mm-hmm. on blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I tried meditation and I was like, I can't do this. I have a million things to do. And that has been with me ever since. And that one meditation I brought into like a lot of treatments with me because it talked about breathing in, I am breathing out calm. And it just made me feel calm. It's everything. It's the one thing I preach to everybody is meditation and breath work.
Yeah. And talk to us a little bit about how meditation and breath work are synergistic, but then also different.
Yeah. So breath work for meditation, you know, everybody's different and there's no right or wrong way to do this. Like people think you have to be in total silence, sitting in a particular situation, and you don't. It's literally, I listen to a guided meditation. It's what works for me. And with breath work, it's just bringing this calm within you. There is the simplest breath work that I tell, you know, a lot of people to do is just, it's 16 seconds. It's breathing in for 4, holding at the top for 4, releasing for 4, and holding at the bottom for 4. It's 16 seconds. And that takes us from fight or flight, where we're in total freak out mode, to the parasympathetic calming state. And it just feels so good. Feels so good just to do that.
And there's so many out there that are, you know, so fast, so quick, right?
Yes.
Just to refocus, recenter yourself. What happened, you know, in the next few weeks to come? Because I want to really talk about the after, but walk us through that initial, those few weeks. What did life look like?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of waiting. And I think that's one of the hardest things with a diagnosis is waiting on like, what are your next steps? At least that is for me. So it was a lot of like distracting myself as much as possible mm-hmm. With exercise and just trying to do calming things, being with family. So I had the biopsy and I had to wait for results on that. And then they called me with my diagnosis and it was stage 1, grade 2 invasive ductal carcinoma. And it was in my left breast. So immediately what happens is they set you up with a team. And it's interesting because with Darren, I kind of took over his care big time. And I was very involved with the doctors. And I did a lot of the research. I researched the doctors that we went to. And I realized in a moment I was having a really like just a tough day. And I was like, wait, why am I not jumping into all this stuff? Why am I not researching these doctors they set me up with? Like, why am I not here? So I started diving in and I checked out local doctors, like who is the best of the best. I started asking around. And I think if you're going to research anything, don't research your diagnosis, research who you're going to go to. And so that was helpful. And I met this amazing surgeon and I think I met with her next. And she calmed me immediately. She was like, girlfriend, you're good. We got this. Like, you know what I mean? Talk to me in a way that was just so calming and not where I was all of a sudden so scared.
How did you handle, actually, let me rephrase this. So different, right? Being a caregiver and being a patient. And it's interesting to me that you said, you know, you were as a caregiver, you know, we're jumping into action, right? These are all the things I have to do. And as a patient, you found yourself a little bit, I don't want to say stuck, but, you know, slower to jump into that
response. Slower to jump into it. Yeah. It's weird when it's yourself. In fact, when Darren was diagnosed, I used to think of his diagnosis as because husband and wife, I kind of took on his diagnosis, but I'm like, okay, no, it's way different when you actually get that diagnosis. And it's hard for me because I didn't want to be sick. I am the one that cares for the family. So it it put me into like a little bit of a funk, and I was really sad. And I kind of feel like I lost my confidence in, like, cause I was, you know, supposed to be this fit and healthy person. And when all of a sudden your body betrays you, you're like, wait, what? And so it took me a little bit. And I, you know, my husband is incredible, but he can't do everything for me like I did for him, because just mentally he can't. So I all of a sudden was like, all right, I need to be an advocate for myself and start doing what I did for Darren for me.
And after that moment, you're at the surgeon, she's telling you, we're going to take care of you. And I think we all need that, right? As the patient, you want someone to just kind of tell you, like, we've got this.
Yes. I went in and I was like, take my breasts, do whatever you need to do. I don't care. I'll do anything. I'm like, my husband has brain cancer. And she was like, girl, you're good. You're good. And she, the way my tumor was 1.2 centimeters. So it was smaller. It was stage one. And, you know, she thought it was going to be a really easy lumpectomy. You know, I did do, some testing as well. And some, what's the testing? You know, just in my his, what's that?
Oncotype testing.
Well, I did that too, but just like my whole, I can't think of it. Anyway, I'll think of it in a second. But so she just talked me through everything. She said, we'll do a lumpectomy. You don't need to do a double mastectomy. You're totally fine. Let's make sure we get clear margins. Let's do a breast MRI. Make sure it's not anywhere else. You know, we went through that whole thing. There was just a ton of testing in the beginning. And then went in for that surgery and she got clear margins. So she didn't have to go back in. The only thing that was really interesting to me, and I still question it to this day, is there was 1 to 2 cancer cells in the lymph node. They removed 5 lymph nodes, but she said that's considered negative.
Yeah. I mean, when we think about lymph node staging, there's kind of 3 categories. So if you have macro metastatic disease, and I always caution that when we use the word metastatic, it does not mean that someone has stage 4 breast cancer. It just means it's spread or metastasized to lymph nodes, but that's not stage 4. So macro metastatic means it's more than 2 millimeters of disease in the lymph node. Micrometastatic is less than 2 millimeters. And then if you have isolated tumor cells, sounds like what you had. That's a different designation. And
when I got my oncotype score back, it was 21. It was in that gray area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it was something my oncologist went back and forth on. And I was like, what would you do? And she gave me her recommendations. And so I shut down my ovaries with Zoladex injections and then was put on an aromatase inhibitor.
And we know, you know, the Oncotype in that gray area has kind of gone through a big revolution in the last few years in terms of how we think about it, how we approach it. But one of the big things is, you know, where can we de-escalate care? You know, and typically for isolated tumor cells, that wouldn't be part, we wouldn't kind of clump you in necessarily with the same decision-making tree as someone who had a, you know, much more lymph node involvement.
Okay.
So where can we de-escalate and where do we need to escalate? And I think really speaking to that individualized shared decision-making, right? Where you're sitting down with your doctor. And I think what you highlight here is how it's so important to trust your doctor, right? Because, you know, I see this all the time. There's so much noise online and social media, your friends, your family, right? My neighbor had chemo. And if you have to trust your healthcare team so that you can have that conversation with them, but you feel confident in the decision that the two of you have made together. Yeah.
Yes, I am. And that's why I say it's so important to research your doctors, because you have to have that trust. And when I said, what would you do? And this is what she said she would do. I was like, okay, let's do it. I trust it. But you know, you always kind of, cause it was that gray area.
Yeah.
And you kind of sometimes wish it was just like, yes, you have to do it, or no, absolutely not. And you're like, well, here's the two sides. And you're like, I hope I did the right thing. But well,
I will tell you now, it's actually, there's an ongoing trial looking at, you know, we don't know if it's the chemo that has the benefit in patients who have these gray oncotypes, or if it's, you know, borderline, like these gray in the gray area. Or if it's the fact that chemo puts you into menopause. So there's actually some ongoing studies looking at chemo plus ovarian suppression with hormone, you know, and endocrine therapy or endocrine therapy with ovarian suppression alone. So we're trying to figure out, like, does everyone need chemo, or is it just that ovarian suppression, shutting down the ovaries, shutting down that estrogen production, is that going to have some of that same benefit?
Yeah. And I felt very comfortable with that. In fact, I ended up, because I was like, how long do I have to do these Zoladex injections for? Because it was just causing some stomach irritation and I was just having some issues with it. And not that everybody does. Everybody's different. We're all unique how we handle these meds. And so I ended up having my ovaries removed.
Can you talk a little bit about that, what that was like for you, the surgery, you know, menopause symptoms? Because I think so often those things are not talked about as much as they can be.
Yes. So I was basically thrown into menopause overnight and I did, you know, get some hot flashes and some night sweats. And, but, you know, I honestly do not think it was that bad. And I don't think it was that bad because of the way I eat. I eat, you know, whole food, plant-based, a lot of soy foods. And I've read up on that. And that is one thing that can really help minimize menopause symptoms. And I exercise, I learned to dress in layers, I learned to stay hydrated. So I tried to look at what the potential things could happen and how I could minimize them. Even the weight gain, you know, a lot of people are so worried they're going to gain weight when they're thrown into menopause. I never gained weight. In fact, I've lost a little weight. So it's what you see and hear about doesn't have to happen to you, but it definitely takes making some changes for sure. The surgery itself, did you want me to dive into that?
Yeah, sure. Just a little bit about what that was like, recovery.
That was simple. The only thing I will say, and I'm so glad that somebody said this to me because it was a laparoscopic surgery, is the gas. So, yeah. You know, they bloat you way up with the gas to do the laparoscopic procedure. And somebody said, your shoulders and neck are going to hurt so bad. So I felt like this such pain in my chest and my shoulders. Like I thought I was having a heart attack. I knew I wasn't, but like, that's how that feels. And that was the only thing, but that goes away after a day. And I was back to like normal routine in less than 2 weeks. And I mean, I was working out in 2 weeks, but honestly, within a couple of days, I felt so much better. It was just two little incisions and it was no big deal for me.
You know, and I think what's important is that you said is that everyone's experience is going to be different, because I think when you Google things, and I have done this as a patient and Googled, and the stuff that's out there is horrendous.
Horrendous.
You know, I just had a hysterectomy and I, after my surgery, was, you know, Googling some stuff. And I joke that if I had Googled before my surgery, I would have never done it, because it's, what's out there is terrifying. And so I think it's the same thing with menopause symptoms. Some people 100% have horrible, debilitating symptoms. And in those patients, we really try to see how can we make them better. But I always caution people in saying that everyone's body is different and everyone goes through menopause in a different way. And I urge people not to take someone else's story and immediately embrace that that's going to be their experience.
I 1000% agree. I even tell people, don't Google the potential symptoms. It may not happen to you. And I think sometimes when we put it into our head, it's going to happen. Our minds are so powerful. So I know one woman who was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I interviewed her on my podcast, and she still to this day does not know her exact diagnosis. Her husband does. You know, she went through chemo, she did everything, but she knows her anxiety, she couldn't handle it. So I think that was pretty powerful. Like, protect your mind as much as you can.
But I think that, you know, protecting your mind, or, you know, I think recognizing how you handle things, you know, is really important. The challenge, I think, is often is that a lot of times people haven't been in that position before, right? They haven't been a patient before, so they don't even know how they're going to feel. And as you, you know, being a caregiver is very different than experiencing it as a patient.
Very different. Yes. Knowledge is power. I think it's really good to know a lot of things, but almost like educate yourself more on how you can take part in the healing instead of what are the potential symptoms of this medicine. Like, I remember, you know, you see like the crazy things that people put out there, like you were saying, in the social media, that is just so fear mongering, like the like people telling people not to get mammograms. Like, are you kidding me? Like mammograms, it saved my life. And I, Dr. Booby Docs, I don't know if you follow her. I'm interviewing her later on this week, but she was saying like a mammogram is like a flight across the country. That's it. Like we all travel.
And we think nothing about taking multiple cross, you know, flights all year round. Right. And yet like one mammogram. But I think the problem isn't, you know, I have a niece applying for medical school and, you know, we were talking about, you know, what are the healthcare issues, right? Plaguing the country. She's like, what do you think are the top issues? And I said, number one is misinformation. I mean, not number one, but very high up there is misinformation, because patients and compounded with the fact that people can't get access to their doctor. They can't get a primary care doctor and so they're going online and then they're seeing this stuff and they see someone with a million followers who's like, hey, mammograms are bad. You're like, oh, okay, I guess they are, right? And for the record, they're not. Please get your screening mammogram.
I mean, I can't imagine if I didn't get mine. I was a grade two. I wasn't like, you know, it was a state, it was smaller, but it was a more aggressive, had more aggressive characteristics. Like, I can't imagine if I didn't go. And I can't imagine being a person deterring somebody to do something like this and having that on my shoulders. Like, I can't believe people take that on.
That's the part of me that like always wonders, right? Like how do you think it's okay to disagree with evidence-based guidelines and promote something? And a lot of it, people are promoting a certain test or a supplement that they're selling, right? So you always have to look at like, follow the chain back, follow the information.
Right.
But I just went for my first mammogram in early January and really, I didn't think it was that bad at all.
No big deal at all.
Like I was prepared for pain and it was, I mean, look, it wasn't pleasant, but it's seconds, minutes of your day. And that's
it's not bad at all. I've never thought it was bad ever.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, this is it. Like you hear all these horror stories about mammograms. I'm like, this is not that bad.
Yeah, no. And I think, you know, speaking to all cancer screening, right? Colonoscopies and pap smears and skin checks, like all of these things are designed to try to keep us as healthy as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So now when did you get your ovaries out? Like how far past this point are we now?
So that was about a year after. Or no, wait. That was about 6 months after. And then about a year and a half later. So I had breast implants prior to my diagnosis. And so it was about a year after my radiation that the breast that was radiated was so just like heavy. I felt like something wasn't right. And I wanted my implants out yesterday. Like I was like done with it anyway. And so they did a breast MRI and my breast surgeon called me and she said, you have a rupture in that left breast. So you need to have that implant replaced. And I just opted to have them both removed, taken out. I just was done with it. I didn't care anymore. So but the interesting part is when I did that, when I had the implants out, the one that was, they said was ruptured, wasn't ruptured. Isn't that weird? I know. Yeah,
that's interesting, right? Because MRI is pretty good at that.
Yeah, yeah, I know. So, but I was happy to have them out anyway.
And, you know, you tell me a little bit about how you advocated for yourself in those moments, right? You felt like, I think so often people, you know, you felt like something wasn't right. And
yeah,
often people feel that, but they're not able to necessarily verbalize like what doesn't feel right. And sometimes they get dismissed because of that.
That's a great question, because there was a couple times where I did say something, I think actually, and I don't know if I was talking to the wrong doctor, but I talked to one of them and she was like, oh yeah, this can happen. And I was like, no, but I really feel like something is wrong. So then I went to another doctor and then that's when she was ordered. You just, if you have to trust your instincts. You know your body more than anybody else. And the doctor might not have the right, you know, it might not be the right doctor. They may not be giving you the right information. If you are really feeling something that needs to be looked at, you need to just keep going.
Yeah.
Getting, you know, more opinions.
Yeah. I think it's hard when sometimes people are telling you, oh, you're fine. Or we see this all the time. But I always tell people, like, you know your body the best. You live in it.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, your doctor is part of your team. And I've always said, but you're also in the driver's seat. You know, this is your life. And I've always taken the part where I wanted to team up with my doctor, where we were in this together and I was involved with them. So I was doing whatever they told me to do. And then I also took, you know, control of what I could control in my own hands, which I think has really given me some peace and sense of control over it. And it minimizes the fear for me because I'm doing so much to help myself.
And what does life look like now as a breast cancer survivor, as a caregiver, as a husband who's a survivor?
Yeah. So let me dive into this a little bit, marriage and how a diagnosis affects a marriage, because I think this is a huge topic that a lot of people, it affects a marriage. And so we've gone through this now a couple times, you know, with Darren. The first time after his second brain surgery, he had a stroke and a lot of complications afterwards. And he was really sick for an entire year. And it was, you know, it was a really hard year on our marriage where I became his caretaker. And I lost that. I've always loved him. He's my best friend in the entire world. But we lost that romantic side to our relationship. And I remember I was visiting a girlfriend and I was telling her, like, you know, there was absolutely no sex on the, can I talk about that here?
Yeah, please. As long as you feel comfortable. I love
talking. Yeah, no, I'm fine. Yeah. There was, you know, nothing like that was happening between us. It was literally patient caretaker and like my really good friend. And so we just had lost that. And I was telling my friend and I had also seen a lot, you know, that he had gone through and our just relationship totally changed. So she said, you need therapy. So I immediately got into a therapist and started talking through things. And we started dating again. And so we started, you know, just slowly dating again. And I started giving him more control, you know, because I was like so in charge of everything. And I was always two steps ahead of him. And my therapist was like, step back a little bit, let him take charge a little bit. You know what I mean? So we got back to having a totally normal, amazing relationship. And then obviously he went through this again in 2019. We didn't have as much setback then, but just a little one. And then 2021 hit with my diagnosis. And that was really hard for me because what we think, you know, breasts that's supposed to be the sexual thing is no longer sexual anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, my breasts just tried to kill me. And I think what had to happen was a really important open discussion with Darren. And I told him exactly how I was feeling, because I think when we have shame over our body or we just don't feel like having sex. We maybe are forced into menopause and that is the last thing on our mind. We're trying to get through treatment or whatever. Like that is the last thing on our mind. But I think by telling Darren, he now understood what I was going through and realized it wasn't him. I wasn't rejecting him. I just wasn't okay in my body. Mm-hmm. I was just not there. And I, you know, that took a lot of work, more work than I think it did overcoming with Darren, because I just being thrown into menopause too, and having all the symptoms like the dryness and just all the things that go along with that. And so it was an open discussion with him and it was really good. And he understood. And we've just had this open communication about it. And then I talked with my gynecologist and she was incredible. And I had a very open discussion with her too. I think we are scared to say things to our doctors and we shouldn't be scared. Like this is our life. Like they have seen and heard it all. And you just got to share exactly what you're feeling and exactly what you're going through and the symptoms. There is a solution to it. And it, even if you don't, I remember in the beginning, my gynecologist, she's so awesome. And she had said, talk to me about vaginal estrogen. And this was, you know, 2.5 years ago, and I wasn't there yet, but she talked to me about other things and things that can help with tightness and dryness and made a lot of suggestions and we got through it. And today I'm now on vaginal estrogen. I had to wrap my head around that, which good Lord, that helps so much.
It does. And it doesn't get absorbed into the circulation. And so we are a big, big proponent of it because it does help people, but I think it does take time. You have to get there. Right. In many ways, both just a little bit of fear, even though everyone's telling you it's okay, there's still some fear, but also I think part of it is like, how did I get to this place where I just skyrocketed into menopause and now I need vaginal estrogen, right? Like, that's a big, you know, that's hard.
Yeah. And it took me, you know, this has been I just went hit my 3-year mark, and this has been an evolution. None of this happened overnight. It's a learning process as you go. It's baby steps. It's a learning and evolving. I've changed so much from where I was when I was first diagnosed, consumed with fear, fighting the change, you know, all the things, to where I'm very happy with where I am now. And I feel good, and I feel like I have a more sense of control over things, especially with how I'm feeling with having the vaginal estrogen. Like, I was having so many bladder issues. Like, that's another thing that goes along with, oh my gosh. Yeah. And so
irritation, frequent urinary tract infections. And I will tell you that it's missed so often, or it's not thought about, right? I will have people come into my office, you know, I haven't seen them in a few months, and they're like, oh my God, I've been, you know, every month they have a urinary tract infection, and I'm on this antibiotic and that antibiotic. And a lot of it is those genitourinary symptom of menopause, of menopause, where it impacts not just the vagina, you know, not just dryness, but your urinary symptoms as well.
Yeah. I mean, and I wasn't prepared for that. And what I learned was that these symptoms just get worse.
Yeah.
Or not symptoms. These things can just keep getting worse. Right. Like the atrophy, and am I right on that?
And yeah.
Bladder issues.
And untreated, you know,
right.
It definitely can get worse. And I think sometimes patients are afraid to bring it up, or it's still a taboo topic, and it shouldn't be, but it is, right? Like, and depending, sometimes people aren't comfortable talking to their doctors about it. And so I always tell people too, if you're not comfortable maybe talking to your doctor, I'd love to change that. But sometimes maybe you feel more comfortable talking to the nurse. Right. Or someone in the office that, you know, because I think that the more open we are about it, I think we're going to move the needle, but it's not going to happen overnight.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Open communication, I think, is so important with your loved ones, you know, your spouse or significant other, and your doctors. Like, that is so important, because it's going to make you feel better.
And I love that you had that communication with your husband, because I think that's also part of it, from what I hear from patients, is that it's really hard to be that open. And I think there's this stigma that penetrates, and we're trying to get rid of this, but the stigma of, well, people get told, oh, you're lucky to be alive, right? Or you're lucky, like, and I always tell people, you can feel grateful that the cancer is gone, and that it wasn't more advanced, and that you know, everything's out now. But you can still feel angry and upset and sad and devastated and all those emotions about how things changed. And you have to grieve the person that you were before. I mean, there's so much mental health impact and process change that has to happen.
So much. When you decide you have to grieve your old self, it's the truth. Yeah. Like, I didn't think that it would change me like it did. And I fought it for a little bit. I really did. And I just remember I would get invited to things, and I just couldn't do the same thing. I was so different. Like, a diagnosis really does change you, but it can also change you for the better if you make really good changes along the way. But if you're stuck in that, trying to be back to who you were prior and not making changes and not accepting what you went through, I think you struggle a little bit. But it's something you're going to go through after a diagnosis. It's like, what it does to your head, it's insane. And I hear a lot of women, you know, we get the diagnosis and we're waiting on the test, or we're waiting on the results, we're waiting on our plan. We start treatment and it's like, go, go, go constantly. And all of a sudden everything stops and you're like, wait a minute, who am I now? And I'm just supposed to go back to life. Like, it's a confusing time. And I think that's a time where therapy is really needed. And it's just kind of figuring out different ways that you push forward, and how is this going to change you?
And I think the other part of it is that you are going to experience different emotions at different points.
Yes. Right?
It's important to check in, because sometimes people will say to me, they're 6 months out and they're like, no, I feel good. Right. I'm everything's okay. And then 2 years later, you may feel very differently. So it's okay to recognize that things can change as we grow and as we evolve as people, right? Your past is going to become part of it in different ways.
Right. Absolutely. And that's the other thing. It's feel it all. Feel the emotions. Mm-hmm. You know, we as women, we try to be the strong ones. Mm-hmm. We're the caretakers, we're the moms, we're the wives, we take care of the homes or what and work and all the things. And we just try to be strong. And you've got to let your guard down and you've got to let people in to help and you've got to feel all the feels. And you can be angry and mad and sad and why me and all the things. It's okay. Those are all normal feelings. You got to feel it all. I mean, I remember I was fighting crying for a little bit and my therapist was like, go watch a sad movie.
Yes. Yeah.
She's like, you need to get some tears out. I'm like, okay. So it's like good. It's therapeutic because you get those tears out and that sadness out, then you can put that smile back on your face and like figure out, okay, what do we do next?
And I think too, people, especially in the young, you know, people get a lot of support when they're going through chemo, right? Where they're going through surgery and radiation and then that ends. And people are like, oh, you're fine now, right? Like you're good. And that's when people actually need the most support because they're now navigating this new life. But they don't feel like they have the ability to be sad or to show their emotions. They feel like they have to be like, all right, I'm strong. I'm moving on. And I think that's where too, there can be a lot that part's really hard.
So hard. And that's exactly it. People think when you ring that bell, you're all done and celebrate you. And it's not. I really think that's when the true healing begins.
100%. And
yeah,
we just don't talk about it enough. So people feel like their emotions are not validated. They feel like they're alone. They feel like there's no one around to help them. And I always encourage people to try to connect with others who are going through something similar, because as much as your friends and family want to help, they're not going through something similar.
Yeah, that is exactly why I created the community. It's like your friends and family and loved ones can give you all the support, but they just don't get it. They just don't get it until somebody has gone through a diagnosis. And it's so crazy. Like you connect with somebody who's gone through it and you're like, oh, we get each other. Like you immediately get each other. Cause we've been in the same shoes. We've been through it. Like it's that whole sisterhood. What is it? The club that you never really wanted to be part of, but once you're in it, you've got friends for life. It is the truth.
Yeah. And I think that recognizing that you have to, it's that community takes a little bit of work to create or harness or find. But once you find it, I can't tell you how many of my patients, and I love this when they meet and they become friends. And two of my patients sent me a photo the other night and they were having dinner at each other's houses.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Their families. And she's like, you know, we would have never met, but we feel such a kindred spirit to each other now.
It's incredible. We're all planning on next year going to the Donna, doing that next year. So we're excited. A girl in the community who did it. And I'm like, wait, what? We all need to do this together. So it's incredible.
And tell me a little bit about your community and the work that you do.
Yes. Yeah, so I went when I was diagnosed. So we've always had a podcast show. We talked about Darren's cancer and then kind of just life and navigating kids. And when I got my diagnosis, I was kind of like, okay, God, like I hear you loud and clear. I'm on this earth to help people through cancer and be a shining light. Mm-hmm. So I became an integrative health practitioner. I just try to teach the healing aspect of it, the wellness side of it after you get through the treatment or as you're going through it too. But, you know, the community is just such an incredible space. We do weekly calls. There's like a toolbox, people who want to work on getting more plant-based into their diet, whole food plant-based, if they want to work on exercise and meditation and just all the things. It's just a great community. And then I have my podcast, of course, Not Today Cancer, where I've had you on, and once a week it's Darren and I, and he's always hysterical. He's quite funny. And yeah, so I am just help women get through a cancer diagnosis.
That's amazing.
I share a lot on social media. Yeah.
And before we wrap up, you know, I always like to end with some tangible tips or things that people can take away from. So, you know, you are an integrative coach and do a lot of amazing healing work. What are three, if you can give a survivor three tips, what would they be? Mm-hmm. And I'm putting you on the spot because we didn't go over this.
That's okay. This is easy for me. This is easy. So the number one thing, I think the number one thing is to minimize stress. And like we were talking about earlier on in the show, like we can't always, like we all live in this world where there's phones and computers and TVs and people, and it's just chaos. It's bringing in that breath work. So bringing in that just 16 seconds a day, 16 seconds. You're having a stressful day. Pause for 16 seconds. Nobody has to know what you're doing. You don't have to go sit in some yoga position. Just sit there and slow down your breath. That alone is just going to help you so much. I think meditation is a big piece of it that kind of goes together. I think exercise is so important. I think people overthink this. They think they have to go to the gym and do hour-long workouts. It's not. It's getting outside. It's taking walks. It's looking at the beauty around you. I think one of the gifts we get from a cancer diagnosis is we just see things differently. Like I'm looking outside, I'm looking at the trees and the green and the sun is out. And like, you just see the world differently. And then lastly, I think is just really looking at your diet. I knew immediately I wanted to look at what I was doing prior, and I never blame myself, but I looked at like, okay, what was I doing prior to my diagnosis? And what changes should I make? And diet was one of the main changes I wanted to make. And so I started introducing more plant-based foods. I was keto before, eating meat and, you know, like probably one vegetable that I did on repeat every day. And now I eat like tons of fruits and vegetables and beans. And like, it's, I love the way I eat now.
And yeah, when you mentioned that it helped with hot flashes, there's data that, you know, there was a study where they gave participants a vegan diet and half a cup of cooked soybeans per day. And they found such a decrease in the amount of hot flashes, right? Yes. So our diet does make a difference. And I always, during COVID, my husband said, I had always been on him to eat more plants, but he was really like a meat and potatoes kind of guy. And somehow during COVID, he's like, you know what, let's give this a go, right? Like the world, everything was changing. It's funny because he's full-fledged vegan.
Really? That's so awesome.
And he loves it. And so I'm about 80% plant-based, but I like fish and I'll have chicken here and there. But I will tell you, I didn't realize how much better I could feel when we gave up all that animal protein, you know, and I thought I felt great. And I remember distinctly, there was this one moment where I was in my office and just walking down the hall. And I said, wow, I just feel so good in my body. And it wasn't a weight thing. It was just this moment of like, oh.
I know. Well, I mean, I was in the, yes, I was in the fitness and health prior to this. And a lot of people will say, well, what's the point of being healthy if you can get cancer? And I was like, I looked like I was healthy, but I really wasn't on the inside. Like my weight hasn't changed much. I may have dropped a few pounds, but it's not like it's gone up. But I eat so much better. Like just because you're thin doesn't mean you're healthy. It's like, what are you putting into your body? And fiber is another thing. Fiber. Oh my gosh. Fiber is like hugely important.
And I think too, that if you come into something, look, I always tell people there's no, like you said, there's no blame. I have the healthiest people in the world get diagnosed with cancer. And I have the unhealthy, you know, people who are not as healthy get diagnosed. But one, you know, trying to control, be careful about what you eat will not only reduce the risk of other diseases like heart disease, which breast cancer survivors are very high risk for, you know, not very high risk, but, you know, they are at risk due to some of the treatments that we give. And there's a lot of overlapping risk factors, but people who start at a healthier point tend to do a little bit better with treatment.
Yes, I agree.
But it's never too late to start. So that's the other part that I think is important. Just because you didn't do it before, you can start exercising at 75.
Yes. And it's baby steps.
Yeah.
It's, you don't have to overhaul everything at once. It's baby steps. I sometimes tell people, cause they're like, I don't even know where to begin. Just start adding in more fruit tomorrow. Okay. Then maybe the next day, add in an extra vegetable. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, instead of having your typical stir fry with meat, make it with tofu. Like, you know, it's just simple, easy things. Don't overcomplicate it. Baby steps, just moving in that right direction of health.
Yeah. This was just so helpful. And I urge everyone to find and follow you. And so tell us how they can do that.
I am on Instagram mostly, Jen Delvaux, JenDelvaux. And that's my website too, jendelvaux.com. Podcast is not today cancer.
And I urge everyone to check it out because you do such incredible work. And I think
thank you.
you know, you practice what you preach, which I love.
Well, I love you too. In fact, somebody in my community is going to be seeing you next week.
Oh, that's so nice. That's
I know. Great. Yeah.
I love how, you know, it's such a small, the community is small, you know, it's big, but it's intimate. And I do.
Yeah. We all love you. We all love you. I'm always sharing your stuff in the community.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you all so much for listening to this conversation. I loved hearing about Jen's stories, some of the practical tips, and especially the importance of meditation and breath work, especially because that's something that takes very little time, can be done anywhere, and really helps provide some calm and grounding. Jen shared her mission with me, and I really think that came across very clear in this podcast episode, but I'm going to end with it. And she said, "My mission is simple, to help women release their fears, reset their lives, and rise stronger after cancer." And I hope that this episode and this conversation inspired you to do a little bit of that. You can follow Jen at Instagram at Jen Delvaux, JenDelvaux, as well as on her website at www.jendelvaux.com. You can follow me at Dr. Toplinski on all social media platforms. And if you enjoyed this episode or any others of the podcast, I would be so grateful if you can take a moment to leave a rating or review or both on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, wherever you listen, because that helps me to grow the show and to bring it to new listeners. Thank you all for being here, and I will see you soon.